Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Out there somewhere, alone and frightened. At the UN General Assembly, I stood up and I could see that everybody was half asleep. They weren't listening, so I burst into song. Today it's me, tomorrow someone else. I sang a song by Philly Lutaya, one of the greatest musicians in Uganda, soon after he was diagnosed with AIDS. So I sang alone and frightened.
Let's come on out, let's stand together, fight AIDS.
Hello, I'm Noreen Kaleba.
And I'm Sue Armstrong. In this BBC World Service documentary, we're looking at the impressive progress made in controlling the spread of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS.
And we are asking whether the goal of an end to the pandemic by 2030 is really attainable.
As a science journalist, I've followed the AIDS story from the first mention of a strange new virus in 1981. And Noreen, you have some very personal experience of HIV. Can you tell us a little of your story?
Yes, indeed. In 1986, my late husband, Christopher Kaleba, had come to England to study at Hull University. It was while he was there that he was diagnosed with AIDS. It was a big shock that prompted both him and I to decide to do something about this disease. Just before he died, we began to organize and mobilize others who were at the time being diagnosed with HIV, and we formed a support group which we called Tasso. That was the first one in Africa for people living with HIV by people affected by HIV.
Noreen, remind us how the virus is spread.
We now know that the virus is spread primarily through exchange of bodily fluids between a person who has HIV and one who doesn't have it. And sexual intercourse without protection, blood transfusion like my husband had, using unsterilized instruments, but also parent-to-child transmission.
AIDS. It has taken important people of the world, the doctors, teachers, ministers, and our lovely parents.
Then in 1996, you moved to Geneva to work for UNAIDS, the joint UN program on HIV/AIDS, which is where you and I first met.
At that time, the virus was still spreading like wildfire around the world, and the prospect of ending the pandemic was just unimaginable.
Over the four decades since the pandemic took off, we've seen around 40 million people worldwide killed by HIV. Today, around the same number of people are living with the virus, and many of them are long-term survivors.
Surviving AIDS.
Kupulumuka AIDS.
Surviving. Back in 1997, the BBC World Service ran a series on surviving AIDS. Though at that time, the prospects were grim.
Surviving AIDS.
The situation was particularly grim in my own country, Uganda, where the epicenter of the epidemic was Rakai District. Then, every homestead in every village seemed to have fresh graves among the banana trees, and so many orphaned children were being cared for by their elderly grandparents. Journalist Adam Lusekelo described his visit to Rakai.
I met one little girl in Uganda that I shall never forget. Her tiny body was huddled into an old hooded cardigan against the chill of the rainy season. She sat on a bench next to her elderly grandmother with eyes downcast and her pencil-thin legs dangling above the ground.
The Namunyumya Dorothea.
She's Dorothea Namunyumya. She's 7 years old. These days she's unable to go to school because she has become particularly weak. And she had boils, the whole body had wounds. But lately she has developed another complication of vomiting. And that seems to be weakening her and dehydrating her very fast. and this is a grandmother who she's the one who looks after her. Gwene miaka emeka. Ansonyo kubuza.
Emyaka nkaga.
The grandmother is 60 years old, but she's now looking after Dorothea.
Noreen, I understand that you yourself have had to look after some of the children left behind by your brothers and sisters who've died. How many children have you had to bring into your nest, and what sort of impact has it had?
Soon after I lost my husband to AIDS, it was like a tsunami that entered through my front door, because subsequently I lost brother, sister, brother-in-law, their wife. And so in total, the children that I have had to look after directly has been 28 children. And my key role was to find the financial resources to provide food, shelter, and education. I really couldn't have been able to do it without the financial support of my friends, a network of people that I've met during my work.
In 2015, an end to the pandemic by 2030 was adopted as one of the ambitious UN Sustainable Development Goals and signed up to by all member states.
I am Winnie Byanyima. I am the executive director of UNAIDS, the United Nations Joint Programme on HIV/AIDS. We say we want to end AIDS by 2030. By that we mean to have reduced new infections right down from where they were in 2010 by 90%, so that there's hardly any new infections. And we also mean that we reduce deaths completely.
Scientists have made huge progress in understanding just how HIV works and in developing drugs to treat people with the infection, and drugs also to interrupt the spread of the virus. Peter Sands is the executive director of the Global Fund to Fight HIV, TB and Malaria, an international financing and partnership organisation set up in 2002.
We don't have a cure, but when the Global Fund was first created back in 2002, it cost about $10,000 per year to treat somebody with antiretrovirals. And that was prohibitive for people in many, many parts of the world. And too many people died as a direct result of that cost. We're now in a situation that antiretroviral treatment, the drugs for 1 year, cost less than $45 a year. And that's the result of working with pharmaceutical manufacturers, both collaboratively and through a lot of pressure, to ensure a continued trajectory of downward price reductions. We can, with antiretroviral treatment, enable people who are HIV positive to live long, happy, productive lives. And that is a huge thing that's been achieved.
I'm in northern Botswana, one of the countries worst hit by AIDS when it first began in the 1980s and 90s. I've come to an area known as the Panhandle of the Okavango Delta, where the river comes in from Namibia and spreads out into the huge delta in the Kalahari Desert. I've come to a village which is remote from many services to meet a woman who has been living with HIV for many years.
She said she is affected in 2011. Long time ago, people were dying, but now it's not like before. They don't go to the burial every weekend.
We've experienced such a drastic change in how we experienced funerals. In the village of Samichima, which is roughly 2,600 people, the whole of the year 2023, we went for the whole 12 months without a funeral.
On a hot, windy afternoon in the Okavango Delta, I spoke to Dipozo Maitio, director of Pabalelo Trust, which works with marginalized communities to promote more sustainable livelihoods.
During the time when I was growing up, there was not much that the government was doing except knowledge dissemination, like the ABC campaign was abstain, be faithful, condomize. That was the theme when we were growing up.
Did you have family members who passed away?
Around 2002, I lost an uncle under those mysterious conditions, because then I didn't know what was happening. And then in 2005, I lost a brother. Unfortunately, didn't access the medication. Since then, a lot of people enrolled into the ARV treatment, and they're still here.
She says they are helping for the treatment.
How easy is it to get her drugs? Is there a health post nearby or what?
She says the problem is that the healthy facilities, they were far. They were taking pills from Maung, almost 400 kilometers. But after the facility came in Shakawe, the healthy post came closer to people. It was better.
So do any of you feel that HIV is still a threat in Botswana, or do you feel the threat is now contained? Do you know what to do about it?
I think in Botswana we know what is HIV is, and we know how to deal with it. These days, the condoms, they are all over. There is the social media. We have phones, we have radios, and people have learned a lot about protecting themselves from HIV/AIDS.
It is so good to hear about the progress made against HIV and AIDS in countries like Botswana, which was once so devastated by the pandemic. But the ultimate protection, of course, would be a vaccine.
The fact is that the virus mutates so rapidly that it's proving an enormous challenge to develop a vaccine that's effective against all strains. But there are some interesting new ideas being explored for treating the infection.
Winnie Byanyima, the executive director of UNAIDS.
We have long-acting injectables for both PrEP, prevention, and for treatment. We have on the market already a long-acting PrEP that is an injection for 2 months. If you take that injection, you will not get infected, even if you have sex with someone who's infected. There is also a long-acting treatment. But now there's even a six-month injectable that has been proven to work as a treatment and is also testing it for PrEP. So think about it, that someone could have 2 injections in a year and not get infected. That is really, really a game changer, particularly for people who are criminalized or people who are stigmatized. If we can move them quickly to make them available as soon as possible to reach those who need them, we can reach a point where we reduce new infections significantly down to almost zero, and we reduce deaths to zero.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Huge investments have been made in Africa in the last 40 years to help combat AIDS.
Tanzania is one of the countries that's well on the way to achieving its UN targets, with an estimated 83% of people living with HIV aware of their infection, 98% of them taking antiretroviral drugs, and 94% of those on the drugs managing to suppress the virus below detectable levels.
We have achieved a lot. If you take from 2000, where the prevalence was 9 to 10 here in Dar es Salaam, currently, survey which was done in 2022, the prevalence now it is 4.2.
Dr. Ayub Kibau is Regional AIDS Control Coordinator for Dar es Salaam. He explains how this dramatic fall in prevalence rates has been achieved.
There's a lot of strategies in the region we are doing, starting from HIV testing. We are providing also some prevention services to the community, including providing of PrEP with a drug for prevention of HIV to the community. And also we are doing this test and treat strategy for all who are diagnosed with HIV positive. They are initiated on ART within 7 days.
The waiting room here at Mnazi Moja Hospital in Dar es Salaam is crowded with people of all ages, most sitting patiently on rows of chairs or standing against the walls as they wait to be called by the nurse or doctor.
My name is Dr. Zainab Mwenyemku. I'm in charge of this care and treatment of HIV at Mnazi Mmoja Hospital.
There's an air of calm efficiency that's so different from the palpable fear and desperation of outpatients' clinics in the early days of the pandemic, when many people arrived at hospital close to death.
About 10 years ago, you can saw many in a stretcher or in a wheelchair in a very bad condition. But nowadays, you can see our client. All of them, they look healthy. So there is a big changes.
Do you find that people, when their viral load is really low and suppressed, they think, that's the end, I've finished it, and they don't take their drugs? Or is that not a problem?
No, we counsel them, viral not be suppressed without treatment. They do physical tracking for those who didn't come for 3 days consecutive.
Taking ARVs exactly as prescribed by the clinic is very important, because interruptions in treatment allow the virus to develop resistance to the drugs. Already, new combinations of drugs, known as second-line and third-line therapies, are having to be used where resistance to first-line drugs has developed.
When the first line failed, then we initiate the second line. We have 5 clients who failed the second line, got the resistance second line, then we shift them to third line. But when they use effective, they didn't fail.
Drug resistance represents a serious challenge. Second-line therapy is typically around 3 times the cost of first-line therapy, and third-line drugs can cost up to 18 times as much as first-line.
HIV is a formidable opponent. It continues to evolve, which is one of the reasons it's so difficult to work out how to develop a vaccine.
Peter Sands is the executive director of the Global Fund.
You need the focus and you need the disease-specific interventions and drugs if you're going to beat a disease like HIV. But you also need the supply chain. You need the laboratories. You need the community health workers. If you don't have those as well, you're not going to win.
Over the last 40 years, lots of non-governmental organisations or civic society organisations have sprung up all over Africa, largely funded by international donors and organisations.
That was the innovation of HIV, of taking the disease out of the clinic and fighting it in the community. So a whole community infrastructure was built where communities did prevention work, did testing work, and they started even doing treatment and care.
My name is Atusege Mongomale. I work for Sikika, a civil society organization advocating for access to quality health services for all. The civil society have a great role to play. They are able to reach where the government cannot reach. So we are here to complement the government efforts. The community health workers come from the community itself. They have been entrusted by the community to be able to see who are the HIV vulnerable community, whether it's the children, the pregnant mothers, are they able to go for HIV testing? Also ensuring that the babies born from the HIV pregnant mothers, they're also able to get the early infant diagnosis so that they can get the required HIV management. They also act as a bridge between the community and the health facility to ensure that the people who are already on treatment adhere to the treatment.
In Dar es Salaam, I spoke to Pastor Emmanuel, a long-term survivor of HIV infection.
Initially, we were supposed to take medication in the morning and in the evening. But now with the combination of all the medications and only take once a day, it makes it easier and also encourages most people to continue taking their medication.
How often do you have your testing for the viral level?
Every 6 months.
And is your virus completely suppressed?
Yeah, mimi binafsi.
For him, if you go and test him right now, he'll turn out negative.
This is possible because ARV drugs stop the virus pouring out copies of itself and clear HIV from the body fluid so that it's no longer detectable. But the drugs don't kill the virus, so it can hide away in a dormant state and become active again if ARV treatment is interrupted.
Antiretrovirals are free. Rama was 5 years old when he was diagnosed HIV positive, shortly after his mother died of AIDS. Today he's on antiretroviral treatment and his viral load is almost completely suppressed.
You can't even know if I'm living with HIV/AIDS unless I tell you. The virus is part of me, but they do not define me. So I embrace my virus in me and I just continue living like nothing is happening. So I actually really never think about HIV/AIDS. Never. I'm more worried about my future for me and my family.
Noreen, I'm struck by how ready people are to talk of their experiences of living with HIV. Because in the early days of the pandemic, I remember, infected people were terrified of being identified.
Yes, when my husband Christopher arrived home from England in 1986, desperately ill, I was forced to care for him myself because no healthcare worker in Uganda would touch him.
Then, of course, there was very little understanding of HIV and no treatment. So how is AIDS seen today? Johnny, another long-term survivor I met in Tanzania, says the stigma has really reduced, but it hasn't completely disappeared.
In 1995,
when he got diagnosed, like you go somewhere, if you sit somewhere and then someone knows like you're HIV/AIDS, they will leave because they are scared of you. But now people just sit with you, they'll talk to you and they'll do everything else because there was so much campaigns talking about HIV/AIDS and there was so much awareness that has been created. So the stigma is really low. But there is a silent stigma.
Noreen, I remember when I first went out to cover the story of AIDS in African countries, there were billboards everywhere about HIV and how to protect yourself and lots of messaging. Things have changed dramatically since then. How are the messages being got across now?
The billboards that were almost everywhere were funded by donors. Radio and television messages were all being aired free at the beginning of the pandemic. Now, as time went, there has been a dynamic. I mean, we are talking about a response that has been close to 35 years. The medium through which young people get information has changed a lot. They see YouTube, they do TikToks, but the reality, young people in my village have no access to internet. I think even globally, we kind of went into some kind of a complacency, partly because we felt, well, the message has been heard, forgetting that we are talking about a population that is growing. Young people are being born today, and they need the same information.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
What are people around the world doing to help tackle the climate emergency?
Climate shocks that we are experiencing.
Droughts, floods, decimated agriculture and so on.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service looks for answers to those challenges posed by climate change.
How can we solve this?
It's all being discussed.
We only hear the bad stuff in the news, don't we? And there's loads of quiet progress.
Reasons to be hopeful.
Solutions exist. We just need to be able to implement them at scale.
The Climate Question. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In this BBC World Service documentary, we're looking at the impressive progress made in controlling the spread of HIV.
And we are asking whether the goal of an end to the pandemic by 2030 is really attainable.
If you take a country like Malawi, one of the poorest countries in the world, in 2000, life expectancy in Malawi was 46. By 2019, so 19 years later, life expectancy was 65. So that's a 19-year increase in 19 years. Two-thirds of that 19-year increase in life expectancy in Malawi were due to the reductions in mortality of HIV, of TB, and malaria.
Peter Sands is the executive director of the Global Fund to Fight HIV, TB, and Malaria, an international financing and partnership organization set up in 2002.
I could point to a whole range of countries, particularly those in Africa, that have seen similarly dramatic improvements. So while we're not on track to achieve the 2030 targets, we should also celebrate what has been achieved, because it's by no means a small difference.
We still have 630,000 people who died of HIV-related diseases last year. We had 1.3 million people newly infected globally last year. Conflict, climate change, and poverty are making it difficult to have a strong HIV response.
Winnie Byanyima, the executive director of UNAIDS.
Climate change is displacing people, destroying weak infrastructure, cycles of floods, followed by drought in the next season, extreme weather events. What I hear from ministers of health is that every time the flood comes, it washes away the centers where people come for their treatments. People are displaced. We have to find them where they are and start again putting them on treatment. And conflict disrupts completely. And the stories I am hearing from Myanmar, from Sudan, and even Ukraine, while every effort is being made to find people where they are and to keep them on treatment, I think in these countries we are going to see the progress halting.
If you're HIV positive, you face a pretty stark choice. You get treatment either in your own country, or you try and find it elsewhere, or ultimately you will get very sick and you will die. So it should be no surprise that they're going to look for it elsewhere.
In South America, for example, thousands of Venezuelans have become medical migrants, looking for vital medicines that were difficult to get at home. Ruth Evans has been to Peru to investigate.
So this is a very lively square in downtown Lima, in front of the Hotel Bolivar, one of the best hotels in Peru at one point. People playing music, live music in the park, and a lot of people around here.
In this prominent location, a non-governmental organisation, the AIDS Health Foundation, runs a regular mobile HIV testing clinic in the back of a converted ambulance.
My name is Juan Carlos Miñano. I'm the testing manager of IHF Peru, and we are right now in San Martin Square, and we are looking for people who doesn't know the status about HIV. We work always here.
By bringing the mobile clinic here, you can be more effective, because this is where the vulnerable people are.
Yes, because this is the number one place, I think, men would have sex with men, transgender people, and sexual workers. This population has always a high rate of HIV positive. And the mobile unit is very useful for that.
Richard, thank you for talking to us today. Is this the first time you've been here?
Sí, la primera vez. Solo estaba pasando, vi.
He was going by and he saw that it was a free test, and that's why he decided to stop.
Yeah. Does it make a difference that the clinic is coming to you rather than you having to go to the clinic?
Es más fácil. No tienes que estar haciendo.
He says it's much easier because you don't have to queue. There are long queues in the clinics or hospitals. You don't have to make an appointment. He just went by and had the test done.
After a diagnosis of HIV positive, what we do is link them to care, taking them to the hospitals to receive the treatment, so we don't leave them alone.
Support them throughout. Do you get a lot of migrants, of Venezuelans coming here as well?
Yes, we have many migrants work here, where they are vendors or sexual workers, men and women. They come in order to get the treatment, because in their country they don't have it.
They can't get antiretrovirals because the health system is in a bad way there.
Yes, in a bad way. So they come, but for enter to the treatment, they need to be tested first. So we test them and then help them in all the procedure for getting the treatment.
And why do the Venezuelans come to Peru, do you think? Is it because the treatment is free for all here, whether you're Peruvian or foreigner? You can get access to treatment here where you can't so easily in Colombia, which is much closer to Venezuela.
Yeah, here in Peru it's easier for everybody to have the treatment. In other places you must have an insurance, but not here. Here the treatment is open for everybody. And that's the reason why many Venezuelans come here in order to save their lives.
Your name is?
Keider Andrea.
And you're from Venezuela?
Soy de Venezuela, sí, correct.
How long have you been here in Peru?
He estado viviendo aquí...
He's been here 6 years and a few months.
Bueno, vine acá por un tema de salud que tenía en Venezuela.
He says he had health problems in Venezuela. He was positive in 2017, but he didn't get any medicines, so that's why he had to come here.
And you have been able to get free antiretrovirals here in Peru?
Bueno, el proceso fue...
Yeah, he says it was quite simple to go through this. He contacted the organization and they took him to a hospital. They went through the whole process and the whole protocol of how his treatment will go. And after 4 months, he started getting the treatment.
And how is your health now?
Yo me siento muy bien realmente, estoy trabajando.
He says he feels fine, he can work, he can even do sports. Since 4 years ago, his viral... it's low.
So your viral load is suppressed?
It's suppressed, sí, yeah. Es correcto. Claro, igual en mis relaciones sexuales sigo utilizando condón porque...
He says, even though he probably won't infect anybody, but he can re-infect himself. So he says that's why he uses a condom.
Thank you. Some of the people that are coming from Venezuela, they've been on antiretrovirals in Venezuela, but then couldn't get the drugs anymore. So they've had a break in their treatment. They haven't adhered to the treatment plan. So do you see a lot of drug resistance happening as well amongst the migrants?
Yes. Fortunately, there are several schemes of treatments.
And what sort of strain is that putting on Peru's ability to deal with HIV-positive people? If you have a lot of influx from Venezuela, is that stretching your resources in Peru?
Fortunately, we have treatment for everybody.
But does it worry you that your services here might be overwhelmed by migrants?
Well, I think they are human beings. And they need to be helped. That's our aim, to help people to get diagnosed. I think it's a matter of human rights. Yes.
Ruth Evans reporting there from Lima in Peru. This is the documentary from the BBC World Service. Noreen, apart from sexual transmission, another risk factor, of course, was blood transfusion and unsterile instrumentation and so on. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Transmission of HIV infection through blood is one of those areas that I thank God that we have come a long way. My late husband, Christopher Kaleba, was infected through a blood transfusion after being involved in an accident in Uganda in 1983. And by 1986, he was diagnosed. From that beginning, we pulled our resources together as a global community and been able to subsequently make a clean blood available.
My name is Mona Harith Mahmoud. I was the manager of the blood service in Zanzibar for 10 years. It started as a national service for the whole Tanzania under the support of the President Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief through Center for Disease Control. But before it was started, when you want blood, you have to look for a relative to come and donate. And we have witnessed a lot of deaths because blood was given without all the tests being done. Those days, there was no disposable items. We had to reuse most of the syringes, needles. It was a disaster. And thank God that with all this support that we had from the President Emergency Plan and other funders, it really helped a lot.
We're now in Zanzibar, just off the coast of mainland Tanzania. The islands are home to just under 2 million people, most of whom are Muslim. Dr. Ali S. Ali is director of the Zanzibar AIDS Commission.
The first case of HIV was diagnosed in 1984 in Zanzibar. Since then, it has been spreading. What we have seen is changing. It's changing from the generalized epidemic to concentrated epidemic. So at the moment, we have higher prevalences and new cases among the men who have sex with men, the female sex workers, and the people who inject drugs.
So you're seeing rising rates amongst those people still?
Yes, the prevalence among people who inject drugs and MSM was around 5%, but now it has been risen to around 11%. And the female sex workers, it was around 11%, but now it is rising to 21%. While the overall in a general population, it is remaining below 1%.
I mean, here in Zanzibar, what are the main constraints? Why are these people remain so vulnerable and so unreached by the messages? Is it a cultural thing? Is it a legal thing? What's the problem?
I think it's a combination of all things. We have deep-rooted Islamic culture with some things that are taboo, I mean, to be discussed in public.
If it's behavior that's not acceptable in the community, is it illegal? And I mean, are they putting themselves in danger by being identified?
Our laws, they are not allowed this kind of behavior to work. So we have to work within the laws. But the government is allowing the access to this group so that we can give interventions to them. Not to promote the behavior, but to give intervention to prevent the transmission of HIV and hepatitis.
Noreen, homosexuality in Tanzania is a criminal offense which can lead to life imprisonment. And I understand this is the same in a number of African countries, including your own, Uganda. What sort of impact has this had on the fight against AIDS, do you think?
The immediate impact is to draw away people who are in same-sex relationship from services. Because if you are seen or identified as being in a same-sex relationship, you will have committed an offence. If people don't feel secure to seek those services, they'll not come for HIV testing. They'll not go and pick their drugs for fear of being persecuted. That's the most important impact.
Do you fear that it might roll back all the progress you've made, and you've made considerable progress in Uganda? Do you think this could reverse that?
Yes, definitely. It will slow us tremendously. People in same-sex relationships, women who sell sex for money, are already identified as very vulnerable.
I'm afraid to say there are parts of the world, Eastern Europe, Central Asia, Middle East, which are demonstrating the truth of the fact that if you ignore HIV/AIDS or you allow human rights-related barriers or factors like conflict to get in the way of providing people with access to both treatment but also prevention services, then the disease will increase.
Peter Sands is the executive director of the Global Fund.
The fastest growing epidemics in the world are in those parts of the world. They're not in Africa. And they are from a lower base, but there should be no complacency at all.
New infections are rising. And why are they rising in Asia? Why are they rising in Latin America and Caribbean? Why are they rising in Eastern Europe? It is criminalization. It is stigma and discrimination. These are middle-income countries. Some of them have even good health systems. But the people who are at risk because they are criminalized. In Eastern Europe, we see that it is people who inject drugs. They are very forceful criminal approach to personal use of drugs is what's driving it. In Asia, it is men who have sex with men, it's trans women, and it's about stigma and discrimination.
And in Peru, where, as we heard earlier, there's been a significant increase in infections in the transgender community, a controversial decree was signed by the president earlier this year, classifying trans people as having mental problems. It was eventually dropped after a huge outcry from the LGBTQ community.
Mi nombre es Carla Lino. Soy activista trans ya más de 20 años.
She's an activist, a trans activist, fighting for rights of the trans people.
Hay muchas mujeres trans.
In 20 days, she's seen 14 new cases. In the whole community, there'll be many more. They don't know how to treat us, and they do feel discriminated.
Y el Congreso,
she says the government is doing and undoing laws, but they've always wanted to qualify them as if they are mentally ill.
Sí, me alarma porque
that's definitely alarms her. And why? She says now we have more doors closed than before. This decree is a demonstration of that. I mean, before they had more access to medical, but now they don't. They feel totally discriminated. No?
I worry about this pushback on human rights. The gains that we made, particularly in the 90s, are now being rolled back. There is hardening of views around sexuality, around identity, particularly for women's rights, but also for the rights of LGBTQ people. And this drives people away. That is sad. There are many factors driving it. There are religious groups, there are political leaders who play politics with people's rights. All this is going on. But St. David's, Jamaica, those countries are decriminalizing. You see countries in Africa like Angola, Botswana, Gabon, decriminalizing same-sex relations. So we see progress, even though we see a huge, huge pushback.
Despite all the progress that's been made over the last three decades, Dipozo in Botswana is still extremely worried about the future.
The youth, they don't have the memory of the scary scenarios that we were seeing around that time. So these are the ones that are at risk of contracting the disease because now they don't have the information from the past. They don't know the reality of someone suffering from HIV/AIDS. And the trend right now is sex without protection. It's a very big risk.
Many young people will not have the awareness. So that's the risk that we have. And we see that that is reflected in the high numbers of girls and young women who are newly infected, particularly in Africa. And that's because this is a group of people, women and girls, who suffer disadvantage. Fewer of them are at school. The social norms tolerate sexual violence. The social norms accept early marriage. There's transactional sex because of poverty and all kinds of reasons. So these factors make girls and young women more vulnerable. We see that in the cohort of age 15 to 24 in sub-Saharan Africa, 3 out of 4 new infections are of girls and young women. 3,100 girls and young women get infected every week in sub-Saharan Africa. We know that if a girl can't stay in secondary school, that safety of the school space can reduce her risk by almost 50%.
Funding is now an issue. The world's largest financier of AIDS programs, the Global Fund, has spent more than $60 billion worldwide to fight HIV, TB and malaria in the last 20 years. But it faces an uncertain future. So too does PEPFAR, the US president's emergency plan for AIDS relief.
We cannot take for granted or be complacent about continued political commitment to face HIV/AIDS.
Peter Sands, the executive director of the Global Fund.
In a way, we have the challenge of success. We've seen dramatic reductions in the death toll. We've seen dramatic reductions in the numbers of infections. And we've also seen HIV/AIDS kind of fade from the public attention in the donor countries themselves. It's not seen as a public health threat in most donor countries. And because of that, we see other priorities competing quite effectively. HIV/AIDS is no longer the flagship issue in global health. And indeed, global health is no longer the flagship priority in development assistance. We need to continue to remind people that if we take the foot off the accelerator, we run the risk of actually going backwards.
So what impact is this going to have on AIDS programming? I asked Winnie Byanyima, Executive Director of UNAIDS.
Funding is still coming, but it's less and less. And you have a crumbling health system. So governments are saying we need to create efficiencies and fight the disease as part of the broader health system. And it does make sense. But now we have to make sure we keep the gains. All the innovations, the rights, the voice, the skills in the communities, community health workers or community-led services with the professionals in the health system, all of that, we're fighting to keep it. We don't want to lose that.
Dr. Ali of the Zanzibar AIDS Commission is also extremely concerned about the effects of dwindling funds for HIV/AIDS services.
Oh, that is a very big issue. The situation is very critical. Reducing new cases is one thing, but to maintain that low level, it needs a lot of resources. But with the reducing of fund, we are anticipated that we have a lot of low level of adherence because we cannot sustain the advocacy. And then the resistance will come up. And one patient on the third line, in terms of cost, is equivalent to around 100 patients in the first line.
So, Noreen, if the funding is reduced, what's this going to do to supplies of antiretrovirals? Because I understand an awful lot of those are financed by international donations.
HIV is a global pandemic, so the response has to be global. Now, if, for example, in the Northern Hemisphere, we have mechanisms through which funding is available for ARVs for those who need it, but we don't have in the rest of predominantly Southern Hemisphere. We now are totally dependent on the Global Fund and PEPFAR money in Africa for ARVs. I'm not aware of any government that buys ARVs from their own local resources. So which means that if the funds that we have available in as a global community, if those stop, then disaster befalls the globe.
We have 40 million people living with HIV. Of those, 30 million are now on treatment. But there is another 9 million and more whom we still have to bring on treatment. The low-income countries with the highest burden, and even middle-income like South Africa with 7.5 million people living with HIV. It has the largest program in the world. In Mozambique, with almost 2 million people living with HIV. Uganda, 1.3 million people living with HIV and 50,000 new infections every year. These countries today are also highly indebted. They are paying four times more to interest payments servicing their debt than they are putting in their health systems. My worry is that these countries are going to fail to make the transition to pay for their own HIV responses, and that people who are now virally suppressed will start missing out on their treatments, and we're going to see a resurgence of the pandemic if the poor countries, particularly of Africa, are not supported to make a safe transition.
So, Noreen, are you optimistic for the future?
We must maintain hope. When I look at 2030, I look at it as a goal. I don't look at it as the finishing line. It is a goal that helps us to focus. We can meet the goal. But if I look at where we are today in 2024, I begin to ask myself whether defeating AIDS by 2030 is feasible.
I'm Sue Armstrong. Noreen Kaliba, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and your personal experience with me today.
It is my pleasure. I am alive, and therefore, whenever I get an opportunity, I raise the voice for those that we have lost. out there somewhere, alone and frightened. Take my hand now, I'm tired and lonely.
This documentary was a Ruth Evans production for the BBC World Service.
Come on out, let's stand together, fight AIDS.
What are people around the world doing to help tackle the climate emergency?
Climate shocks that we are experiencing.
Droughts, floods, decimated agriculture and so on.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service looks for answers to those challenges posed by climate change.
How can we solve this?
It's all being discussed.
We only hear the bad stuff in the news, don't we? And there's loads of quiet progress.
Reasons to be hopeful.
Solutions exist. We just need to be able to implement them at scale.
The Climate Question. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.